I sent out an email this week to remind you of our Torah portion, and jokingly I said, maybe we'll even have a quiz. And the more I thought about it, the more I liked that idea. So we're going to have a pop quiz. So if you've read the Torah portion, you should be able to answer these. So if you have a little scrap piece of paper, you can write down your answer. So here is our pop quiz. Question number one. Now, we read the first five chapters of Genesis. You studied those chapters this week, correct? And they all said, yes, Grant.
Yes.
Okay. All right, so question number one. On which 3 days of creation did God name things? There were 6 days of creation, and the seventh was the Sabbath. And on three of those days, God named things. Which 3 days? Just put down the numbers. 1, 2, 3, 2, 4, 6, 3, 4, 5, 1, 5, and 2, whatever it is. Okay, just which 3 days? Ken, I don't see you writing these down. I'll have to send a note home. Okay. Number two, this is multiple choice. God made man, A, in his image, B, after his likeness, C, in his image and after his likeness, D, in his spare time. Okay, which is the answer? In his image, after his likeness, in his image and after his likeness, D, in his spare time. Question number three. Which day of the week did God bless and sanctify? If you missed this one, you were in the wrong place. All right? And then extra credit. An extra credit one. Four, identify the curses that God placed upon Adam and Eve. Identify the curses that God placed upon Adam and Eve. What were the curses that God placed upon Adam and Eve? Can you name them? All right. Okay, put your names in those papers, pass them forward. I will grade them, and no, I'm kidding. I won't do that to you. So, how many of you think you did pretty well on this? Huh? Did pretty good? All right, let's go over them. On which 3 days of creation did God name things? Days 1, 2, and 3. Days 1, 2, and 3, he named things. On the first day, he said, let there be light. We're going to use this quiz as the outline for the teaching today, if you haven't figured that out. So let's talk about question number one. On the first 3 days, God separated things. And most of you are familiar with this concept. We've gone over it many times in the past. And may I just say that as we go through the Torah this year, I'm not going to try to cover every detail of the Torah portion. That's impossible anyway. We took about a year and a quarter, to go through just the book of Genesis. And all of those teachings are online, and they're on the podcast. And so if you have questions about Genesis, hopefully most of those will be answered in those teachings, because we went into quite a bit of detail there. And then the other teachings on the rest of the Torah, there are several cycles of those found on the website and on the podcast. So if you want to go back and cover a lot of the basics, you'll find the basics covered in those teachings. What I want to do this year, it seemed like at Yom Kippur, that this verse that I shared with you last week kept going through my mind. It's from Proverbs, and it says, the lamp, the Torah is the lamp, and the light is the mitzvah. Or you could say, the lamp is the Torah, and the light it gives off, the mitzvah is the light it gives off. Right? No, it's not right. Come on, folks. You need to pay attention. The lamp is the commandment, and the light is the Torah. Some people tend to think our commandments, the fulfilling commandments, that's the light we give off. No, that's the lamp. That's the physical thing. Proverbs says that the lamp is the mitzvah. That's the physical thing. When you physically obey a commandment, you've done a physical deed. That's a lamp. In other words, it's a potential for light. But it's the Torah itself that is that light. A lot of people think that the entire Torah is just commandments. You take all the commandments out of Torah, you still have a whole lot of Torah left. In other words, the Torah contains something otherworldly. Yeah, it's got commandments. It has physical things you should do. And when you do that, that creates a platform and a potential in your life for light to go forth. But the Torah itself is revealing God to us, revealing His mind, revealing His soul, revealing His ways. And what I want to do in this cycle is to see ways that the Torah reveals God to us. Things that don't necessarily meet the eye, but things that appeal to spiritual sight. So, I encourage you to go back to go over those other teachings to cover the basics. But this year, we're going to try to go a little deeper in certain places. All right. On days 1, 2, and 3, God separated things. On days 4, 5, and 6, He filled those things that He separated. Let's take a look. On day 1, God separated between light and dark. He said, let there be light. There was light. God called the light Yom, day. He called the darkness Laila, night. And He separated between the light and the darkness, between the day and the night. Okay? He called the light day, He called the darkness night. He separated and He named the things. On the second day, He separated the waters above from the waters below. And then He called this separation the rakia, the firmament. Or heavens, as your translation may put it. Now, it's interesting, on this day, God does not say it was good. He looked at what He did and said it was good. Now, of course, it was good, but He didn't say it was good. Why? Because when you take two things that are different and separate them, that's good. When you take two things, or take something that is the same and separate it, that He doesn't call good. Water belongs with water. Okay? But He separated them. There's a purpose, but it's a temporary separation. Because we read in Revelation of the new heavens and new earth, there's no more sea. In other words, the waters are put together and they remain where they're supposed to be, up above. But that's another story. On the third day, He separated the seas from the dry land. And then He called the dry land land, and He called the seas seas. He separates and He names, separates and names, separates and names. But on days 4, 5, 6, He doesn't do any separating, and He does no naming. But He fills the things that He separated on the first 3 days. Day 1, separated between light and darkness. So what does He do on day 4? He places a light to rule the day, and He places the sun, moon, and stars to rule the night, the darkness. On day 2, He separated the waters above from waters below. So what does He do on day 5? He puts fish in the waters below, and He makes birds to fly in the heavens, the rakia above. On day 3, He separates the seas from the dry land, and He makes the vegetation to grow on the dry land. What does He do on day 6? He creates the animals, the land animals, and man, and then gives man rulership over the vegetation and over all the animals. Do you get the idea? But He doesn't name things on those days. This is an important principle. You see, order comes out of separating. Order comes out of separating things. I've mentioned this principle over and over and over again. If you want order in your life, then separate things. You want order in your sock drawer? Separate the blues from the reds from the whites and the yellows, and you match the things that are the same and separate the things that are not. You want to organize your garage? Okay, put the tools for the car over here, and put the lawn equipment over here, and put the chemicals for the weed killers, put those here. Put the things that are the same together, but separate them. Bring order out of chaos. Whenever you bring order out of chaos, you separate things that don't belong together. You got it? And when you do that, things take on an identity. And then God names them. There's a whole host of things in Scripture where we see this principle of separating and naming. Let me give you just a few of them. I was just trying to think of some last night, and so here's a list I came up with. I'm sure you can add many more to it. For example, when a Jewish boy is born, Jewish parents do not name their children before they're born. They don't name their children right after they're born. Especially the Jewish boy, they wait till the little boy is 8 days old, and as the Torah commands, they circumcise the little boy on the eighth day, and then they give him a name. In other words, they wait till the child is separated from the mother before they name the child. And if it's a boy, they wait till the eighth day when he is circumcised, and the unclean foreskin is separated from the little boy, then they give him a name. Another example. In Genesis 2:23, God takes Adam, he removes a side. In fact, the rabbis say God just sawed him in half. He didn't take a rib. That is a total mistranslation. He took a side from Adam. You know, and the way you picture things are important, because if you think, yeah, my wife just came from a rib, but I came from the rest of me. No, she's half. God took a full half to make the bride. And when God separated Adam into Adam and Eve, into Ish and Isha, man and woman, then the woman is named, only after she is separated. Adam, after they are separated from the garden, after they're driven from the garden, then Adam names his wife, Isha, names her Chava, Eve. She's named again. In Genesis 21:12, you find that when... Well, let's just look it up. Genesis 21:12. This is a good passage to read, because the principle is found here as well, if you look closely. In Genesis 21:12, you have got the whole issue of Isaac and Ishmael. And Sarah saw Ishmael persecuting her own child, Isaac. And so she decides that Hagar and Ishmael need to leave. And she tells this to Abraham. Abraham did not like that idea. But as we looked at 2 weeks ago, God told Abraham, listen to the voice of Sarah. We spent the whole morning talking about that verse. And so, in other words, God says to him, go ahead, you need to separate them. And what does he say? He says, so God said to Abraham, be not distressed over the youth or your slave woman. Whatever Sarah tells you, heed her voice, since through Isaac will offspring be considered yours. In other words, he names, and in some of the translations it says, it's in the name of Isaac that your children be called. Then they will be named. And so, again, Isaac's name is emphasized after the separation. We see this principle even more clearly over in Exodus 26:33. In Exodus 26:33... this is a great picture. This is the picture you can hold in your mind. God is giving instructions about the tabernacle. And you shall hang the veil from the clasps and bring the ark of the testimony in there within the veil. And the veil shall separate for you the holy place from the most holy, or the holy place from the holy of holies. Picture the picture here now. You've got this room made up of these planks covered with gold. They're fastened edge to edge. Do you have a holy place in the Holy of Holies yet? No. Not until you put the veil that separates, do you now have a Holy of Holies in the holy place. Before the veil, it's just a mixture. But with the separation of the veil, as it says there, that the veil shall separate for you the holy place in the Holy of Holies. And then I thought it was interesting this morning. I'd forgotten that we're going to read Revelation 2, and Dan read the second chapter of Revelation during the prayer service. Because did you catch the part about Pergamum? when Messiah sends the letter to Pergamum, he dictates this letter, and how does he identify himself? As the one who has the sharp, two-edged sword. A sword is used to separate, isn't it? And then what does he say? In Pergamum, there were two groups of people mixed together. There were those who loved God and wanted to follow him, but there are other people who said they loved God. They were very religious, but their hearts were very far from them. And there was a lot of paganism mixed in. It was an ugly scene. So Messiah describes himself as the one having the sharp, two-edged sword. And then he tells his followers in Pergamum to become conquerors. He tells them to stand up, to be different, to move away. And he says that if you do not, that I will, Revelation 2, 16 to 17 says, therefore repent, turn around. If not, I will come to you soon and war against them with the sword of my mouth. He mentions the sword again. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the congregations. To the one who conquers, I will give some of the hidden manna, and I will give him a white stone with a new name written on it. You get the picture? When you separate yourself, when you make yourself holy, you put yourself apart. When separation comes, then God identifies and names things as now they have a new identity. This principle set forth there in the first 3 days of creation. The key to unity is order, and the key to order is separation. What was it before God started separating? It was chaos. It was tohu and vohu. It was chaos and emptiness, and there was choshek. There was darkness. Okay? Get the picture? What's the lesson for us personally? There are things in your life and in my life that are compromising my identity. I am called to be an ambassador for God. I am called to be as much like Messiah as I can be. I am called to be a vessel of light. I am called to be a child of God. And we can go on and on and on what we are called to be. But there are things in your life that are inconsistent with those callings. There are things in your life that compromise the identity God says you are to have. We are children of the Father. That means we bear our Father's traits. But do we sometimes behave in ways that are contrary to our Father's rules? Are there things in your life that are displeasing to God? You see, when you separate those things out, put those aside, your name becomes clearer. Who you are shines forth more. You become more the person God wants you to be. It's a matter of washing away the crud, slicing away the dead stuff, putting away the things that drain your spiritual energies and make you less effective. You know, the Holy Spirit speaking to your hearts as he is to mine. You know what I'm talking about. But we want to be people who bear the name of God and do it clearly without compromise. Or don't we? I mean, do we or not? If we do, God wants to bring order out of our chaos. He wants to bring out of our mixture a clear delineation between light and darkness. And he wants us to be vessels of light. He wants us to walk in the light as he is in the light. And then he and we have fellowship with one another. You got it? Okay. Well, the second question on our quiz was multiple choice. God made man A, in his image, B, after his likeness, C, in his image and after his likeness. And if you put D, you're probably in the wrong place. But the answer is A. It is not C. And you all put down C. It's not C, it's A. Right? How many put C? How many are humble enough to admit that you didn't read the Torah portion? All right, okay. Let's read the verse. Genesis chapter 1. And it's going to be about verse 26, yes. Genesis 1:26. Here's what it says. And God said, "Let us make man in our image, after our likeness. They shall rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the sky, and over the animal, the whole earth, and every creeping thing that creeps upon the earth." So God created man in his image. In the image of God, he created him. It doesn't say in his likeness. Did you catch that? He said, "Let's make man in our image and after our likeness." But he made man in his image, not after his likeness. No, it wasn't a trick question. No. Everything that is the way God, it seems like a trick question. And I couldn't wait to tell you what the real answer was so you'd all be totally embarrassed. I couldn't wait. But I understand that if you put C, because actually, letter place, you'll see where C could apply. So I'll give you half credit on this one, all right, if you put C. But God's purposeful, the way he arranges the words in his Torah, the letters, the words, the order, every single thing in the Torah is absolutely planned out, totally purposeful. And Messiah says even the jots and the tittles, the tagin, the little decorations in the letters have purpose and they are eternal things. So if God says, "Let's make man in our image after our likeness," but then he made him in his image, and twice it emphasizes in the image of God he made him, and it doesn't say that he made him in his likeness, why? Why is that? Well, you know, when you do a study of these two words, image and likeness, zelem and damut, it's not an easy word study to do. It's a very difficult study. First of all, before we look at these two words, let me show you a Hebrew word that God did not use. The word for form, a visual form, is the word to'ar. And nowhere in the Bible is this word applied to God. God did not make us looking like him. Don't you dare think for a second God has a head and two arms and shoulders and legs and ears. Don't think that. God does not have a corporeal body. He does not have a physical body. Period. God is spirit. Messiah tells us in no uncertain terms. God is spirit. He is not physical, period. Okay? So, the word to'ar, a form, a physical form, is not the word used. The word that is used for image is the word zelem. Zelem. Interesting word. It refers to the essence of what a shape attempts to convey. A zelem. It comes from the word zel, which means shadow. For example, when you look at the screen here, the letters, the things you perceive as letters, what you see on the screen is not ink on paper. What you're seeing up there are shadows. The light bulb inside the overhead is projecting the light up through here. It's refracted through this mirror and out the lens, and you see shadows up there. You're not looking at the actual thing. You're looking at shadows of the actual thing, which I can see up here. And that word zelem is kind of interesting because it's zel plus the letter mem. Zel means shadow. The man that God designated to build the tabernacle, Bat-Zelel, in the zel, the shadow of El, God. Bat-Zelel, in the shadow of God, okay? Zel is shadow, but mem is the letter whose name means water. So think of zelem, image, as a shadow of water or a shadow on water. It is no coincidence that our bodies are over 90% water. you're mostly just a walking water balloon, is what you are. But in the shadow of God. The word Zelim itself gives you a picture of what your body is. There's the shape of God. Through the light of God, there's a shape. There's an idea on water. But you can't get much more specific than that. Now, the word Damut, on the other hand, Damut is the one that's translated likeness. Damut. And according to it's interesting looking at Maimonides and Nachmanides and Hirsch and all these great Hebraists and rabbis and Torah commentators, and none of them have the same definitions for either of these words. Because their words are kind of a void being nailed down. But this is about as close as we can get. It's an inner correspondence, an intellectual apprehension. Whereas Zelim is kind of an external thing, Damut is an internal thing. They do pretty much all agree on that. In fact, the Kutnik edition of the Chumash translates, "Let us make man in our image and after our likeness." It says, "in our image and intellectually endowed like us." Because it's like the amplified version of the Torah. It tries to bring out the inner meaning of words. So sum it up this way. Zelim is the external. What's the external? It's like a shadow of God on water. Pretty foggy, pretty vague, but enough to realize we're to represent our Creator and not represent some animal on earth. We're to represent Him. But the word Damut, likeness, has more to do with the internals, the mind, the soul, the spirit. And remember, it says God made Adam according to his Zelim. It does not say he made him according to his Damut. You know, if he had, Adam and Eve would not have sinned. Their Damut had the potential to grow into the soul of the spirit that was like the same with God. Not become gods. That's a lie taught by Mormonism, which they got from Satan himself, because Satan says, the day you do this, you'll be like God. No, I'm afraid you won't be. Or he says, you'll be gods, or be like God. And the lie of the New Age movement and most occultism is, you can be gods. No, you can't. Okay? No. But one of the interesting things about this word Damut, the first two letters, Dalet Mem, Dam, is the Hebrew word for what? Blood, yes, very good. Blood, is that an external thing or an internal thing? The internal thing. And what is in the blood according to the Torah? The nephesh, the life, or the nephesh, the soul, is in the blood. I got it? So even Damut has to do with internality. And you could even pronounce that word Damot, which is the plural of blood, bloods. Another thing too, Zelim is a masculine word and Damut is a feminine word, for whatever significance that might have to you. So, the question is, probably this is what Steve's going to ask. If it's not, we'll come back. Go ahead and ask it. See if it's the same one, I think. He's probably, yes, that was a great question. Where Satan does tempt Eve and Adam. Oh, you got that from Laura. I always said the woman's more spiritual. And this is proof. Here's more proof. Laura, as her question is this what Satan's referring to basically when he tells Eve, and Adam was right there with her, that you use this, you will be like God, knowing good and evil. Absolutely it was. Absolutely it was. And here's the reason it does not say, I know, Adam, you're looking at Genesis 5. We'll get to that in a second. I could read your mind. But this is the reason why it does not say there that he made him after God's likeness. Because you see, here's the truth of the matter. He made him in his image right there and then. But making man, making mankind into God's likeness is something God has been in the process of doing since that day. And here's where it comes to completion. 1 John chapter 3, and we'll start with verse 2. 1 John chapter 3, verse 2. There is a day coming that John was looking forward to. I love this verse. I guess if I have a life verse, this is it. Beloved, we are God's children now. And what we shall be has not yet appeared. Haven't seen it yet. But we know that when he appears, we shall be like him. Because we shall see him as he is. Now, when John wrote this, he had to have been thinking back to the first few chapters of Genesis. Because did Adam and Eve actually see God? Never says that they did. It says the Kol Elohim, the voice of God or the sound of God, would walk in the garden in the cool of the evening. Now, maybe they did see him before they sinned, but the language is very interesting. Because it says they would hear his voice walking in the garden. Now, you'd think, well, wouldn't they miss out seeing him? Why just hear him? Well, that's a question we ask as people on this side of the fall. Because for most of us, being able to see is more important than being able to hear. And being able to see and hear is more important than being able to taste or smell. We've kind of ordered our senses as what's most important, what's least important. But back when Adam and Eve were first formed, I don't think there was necessarily a priority among the senses. I think probably every one of them, all five of them, but maybe there were more that they had we don't know of, was so sharp and so keen that some things you saw, some things you smelled, but one's as good as the other, some things you could hear, but there was full information brought in from that particular sense. I don't know, I'm just imagining. But when you begin to realize that God made Adam and Eve in his image, but he had not yet made them after his likeness, they would hear his voice walking in the garden in the cool of the evening, but not see him yet, because John says there's a day when we will see him as he is, and then we will be like him. You start to get the picture of how it fits together? And what is the next verse? This next verse is very good. And everyone who thus hopes in him purifies himself as he is pure. There's that separation again. He's separating out the things that don't belong. So his identity, his very identity of who he is becomes sharper and a crisper focus. Now, the verse that Adam, chapter 5, right, Adam? Is that what you're going to?
Well, before that, I wanted to ask, neither is all nor the moon are used by Satan. Satan
right, they're not. No. No, he just uses that little preposition of a letter at the front. To say that you'd be like God. He doesn't actually use that word. No. Now you go to Genesis chapter 5, and you'll think, oh, well, Grant's utterly wrong. Everything he just said isn't true. Well, let's see what's being said here. And again, as we teach the Torah this cycle, we're looking at the things that are under the surface. We're looking at the secrets that are revealed there. Because after all, no man has seen God. No one has seen God and lives. People have seen images of God, and God has manifested himself in visual ways, but no one has seen God as he is. All right? No one has seen him in his fullness. Because physical eyes just simply aren't up to the job. God is spirit, so we must have spiritual eyes to see him. And it's spiritual eyesight God is interested in us developing. Because even in the world to come, I'm not sure that we will even see him then with physical eyes. But I think our spiritual vision will be 2020, and we will be able to grasp who he is as fully as it could ever be possible of a human being doing. But God is spirit. Spiritual eyeballs are what are required. And so the Torah, which is a lamp to our feet, a light to our path, the Torah, which is the light of the lamp is the commandments, but the light is the Torah itself. The Torah is to provide light to develop our spiritual eyesight to begin to lay hold of who God is. So anyways, we come to Genesis chapter 5, and it says, Ze Sefer Toldot Adam. This is the book of the descendants of Adam. If your Bible says the account, cross it out. It's the word book, Sefer. That's a Sefer Torah there in the Ark. It's a book of the Torah, scroll of the Torah. Sefer, it's book. This is the book of the generations of Adam. On the day that God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. Uh-oh. Damut. There it is. He created the male and female. He blessed them and called their name man on the day they were created. When Adam had lived 130 years, he begot in his likeness, in his image, for he named him Seth. But the thing is, earlier it says that God made him in the likeness, the Damut. Bidmut Elohim, in the likeness of God. So what's the deal? If he made Adam in his likeness, why does it say so back in 1:26? Well, let's look deeply into what's going on. It doesn't say this is the story of how God made Adam into his likeness. This is the book of the generations of Adam. And though it's in the past tense, oftentimes, things are used in the past tense to show a fact that is established whose outcome is certain. This morning when we were going through the Siddur and we go through the prayer of Mary, where she's been visited by the angel and realizes now she's going to become the mother of Messiah. Look at her prayer. She writes things about the future, but she writes them in the past tense. And this is a common thing. In fact, it even talks about how Yeshua, the Messiah, was crucified before the foundation of the world. Well, wait a minute. Historically, he was crucified many, many thousands of years after the foundation of the world. Why does it say he was crucified before the foundation of the world? Because before God even began creating the earth, he knew the plan. He knew he'd make Adam and Eve. He placed the serpent there, knew they would sin. God was not upset. He wasn't shook. He wasn't shaken up. It's according to the plan. It's okay. I got this figured. Because I didn't entrust Adam with the salvation of mankind. I entrusted Messiah with the salvation of mankind. And though Adam failed, Messiah will not. The first Adam messed up. The last Adam succeeds perfectly. So, look what it says here. This is the book of the descendants of Adam on the day God created man. He made him in the likeness of God. And then it goes on through the 10 generations from Adam up to Noah. Now the chapter before, God gives the 7 generations of Cain's line. And Cain's line went for 7 generations and they're all destroyed in the flood. But here he gives the generation of Seth's line. Seth. And then his children, on down to Noah. And then Noah has Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And so God, he homes in on Shem, where we get the word Shemite or Semite. And through Shem, he shows the line. And then we come on down to Abraham. And then Abraham is called, and God makes a blood covenant with Abraham. And Abraham has Isaac. And then God passes the covenant on to his son, Jacob. And then Jacob has 12 sons, but he passes the covenant and reestablishes it with the 12 sons. But it's through Judah, the kingly line, that we have David. And then the son of David, Messiah. And through Messiah, we get grafted in as children of the Father into his home. And it goes on and on and on. So, and when you look at these 10 generations, And most of you, I know, are very familiar with this. But when you look at these 10 generations, they form an amazing story. And if this is new to you, it's pretty neat. It's neat whether it, even if it's old to you. But these are the 10 names. You know, Adam, Seth, Enosh, Kenan, Mahalalel, Jared, Enoch, Methuselah, Lamech, and Noah. When you take what their names mean, it has a story. Man, appointed, subject to death, sorrowful, lamenting. From the praise of God, one descends, learning obedience. Dying, he shall send to the poor and lowly rest. Zehasefer told Adam, this is the book of the generations of Adam. And it's like God saying, yeah, I'm going to make you into my likeness. I'm determined. The outcome is certain. And here's the story of how I'm going to do it. And the story continues throughout the Tanakh and throughout the Brit Kadashah. And then John stood at a place where he could see even further to the day when he shall appear and we will see him as he is and we will be like him. This is why I give you half credit on that question if you put down C instead of A. Are we made in God's likeness? We're in the process. In his image, yes. In his likeness, we're all in different places on the scale. You know, this week, today is the third day of Sukkot. And the Torah commands us on Sukkot to take what are called the Arba Minim, the four species. It's found in Leviticus chapter 23 and verse 40. And I try to go over this every year, and I normally do it during the prayer service. But I want to share it during the teaching today. Leviticus 23:40 says, now on the first day you shall take for yourselves the fruit of the beautiful tree, branches of palms, boughs of leafy trees, and willows of the brook. These are the Arba Minim, the four species. And Dan alluded to these during the story he read during the prayer service. And you shall rejoice before the Lord your God for 7 days. All right. So here we go. There is the palm, right there in the middle. And then we have the myrtle. And here we have the willows. And these are all put together and held together. And then, but it also says the fruit of a beautiful tree. So there we go. That's called an etrog. Okay? And you're to take this etrog in your left hand and the other three in the right and then bring them together. Why? Remember, everything God puts in the Torah is purposeful. Everything is perfect. Everything has specific purpose to it. Well, if you've ever looked at myrtle leaves closely and willow leaves, you'll notice that the myrtle leaf looks like an eye. It's shaped like an almond. It's shaped like an eye. But the willow leaves are very long, and they look like a pair of lips. And according to the sages, when you take these together as one, it means it takes your spine, that's your strength, represented by the long, straight palm, and you take your eyes, and you take your lips, and you take them in hand, under control, and you bring them together. So your speech, and your eyes, what you look at, and your strength, and your spine, and then the left side is where the heart exists. You take the etrog, because it represents the human heart, and you bring them together. So everything on the inside and everything on the outside becomes one. They become unified. It's like the Zelim and the Damut become one. And what's interesting about this etrog, it has this wonderful fragrance to it. It's kind of like a lemon. You'll notice that it has a stem here. This is where it was attached to the branch of the tree. And when you say the blessing over this, when you take these in hand on the first day of Sukkot, say the blessing, one of the traditions is you take it and you rotate it and you turn it upside down. or right side up, depending on how you want to look at it. But you notice there's another stem. There's the stem on that end where it attaches to the tree. That's the physical connection to the tree. But there's another stem called a pitum, on this end, which attaches to nothing. Or should I say it attaches to no thing. But it's pictured as being attached to an invisible branch, an invisible vine, an invisible source of life. There's a connection to the physical, but a connection to the spiritual, and that's the way our hearts are to be as well. We need a heart which keeps our blood flowing, and it connects with the physical things around us, to the people around us, to the things we have to do, but it must also be strongly attached to God. And so when we do the blessing, we rotate this around like this. And you bring the four together. Now, why did God pick these four? I mean, that's one reason. But there's more to it than just that. One of the interesting things about these four is that one of them... I just lost my overhead. There we go. There it is. As I just mentioned, the etrog represents the heart, the palm, the spine, the myrtle, the eyes, the will of the mouth. But the etrog has both taste and scent. You can eat this. It has this wonderful citrusy smell to it. The palm has taste but no scent. The myrtle has scent but no taste. The willow has neither. This is no accident. And according to the sages, the one who has scent and no taste is like the one who has Torah learning, but no works. And the one who has taste, but no scent, is like the one who has good works, but no Torah learning. And the one without either is like one who has no Torah learning and no good works. But this one has both. That's what's ideal. So the question is, why don't we just throw out the myrtle because it doesn't, or the willow because it doesn't have either one? It's kind of worthless. And God says, no, this represents four kinds of people as well. And to make Israel complete, to make the body complete, you bring them all together. When you have them all together, you don't know where the smell is coming from. Okay? We all share together. And the strong help support the weak. But it's just not complete without the four. And you know, this is such a universal practice, though it may be some to you, but you have to realize that even Rabbi Yoda, you know, takes up the four species. So I just want you to realize this is not something new, all right? So there he is. So any questions over this so far? Now, the reason I'm bringing up the etrog, again, is to show the likeness and the image, to bring up the two, because it's got two stems to it. It's, again, a picture of this important truth. All right, so let's move on. And we'll finish up here shortly. Which day of the week? Yes. Yes. No. The willows and the palms are the ones specifically mentioned by name. The myrtle and the etrog, it just goes back, as far as we know, millennia, that those are the two always used to fulfill those other two things. So only two of the species are specifically stated, but the etrog is what's always used. And sometimes a Jewish man will spend a great deal of money procure a perfect etrog. I can't tell a perfect one from one like this, which isn't really expensive. But sometimes what looks really ugly to me are the ones that are the most expensive. I guess there's a lesson in that as well. It's beauty isn't necessarily based on what you think is beautiful, but what the expert says. And we have an expert says what a beautiful heart is. So, but no, it's a good question. Well, which day of the week did God bless and sanctify? And of course, that's the seventh day, the Sabbath day. I want to make sure you understand something here. The Sabbath day was not established when God gave the Torah and gave the commandments on Mount Sinai there in Exodus chapter 20. Not at all. In creation, God established the Sabbath day. And God, it says there that God blessed the seventh day and he sanctified it. He made it holy. It was only later when the Torah is given, God commanded his followers to keep it holy. It's already holy. Man has no ability to change that. The Sabbath day, Friday night sundown, Saturday night sundown, was established at creation as the day God blessed and made holy. Now what's interesting is that every other kind of measure of time you can establish through nature. You can establish the length of a day through nature. No, cycle of dark and light. You can establish a month through the cycle of the moon, 29 and a fraction days. You can establish a year through the seasons, the constellations. Okay, you can establish all those things. But nowhere in nature, anywhere, do you find something established on a cycle of 7 days. Nowhere in nature. It doesn't exist in nature. It's because it's not natural. It's supernatural. God established it. And by observing the Sabbath, you put yourself in sync with him. Something he did that is as foundational as the creation itself. And as one of his people, he's telling us, now, I blessed this day, and I sanctified it, but I'm going to command you to guard it and to keep it sanctified. Keep it holy. Don't let anything intrude upon this time. This is our together time. This is our time where you and I meet together. I'll be there. I'm available. You've got my promise on that. The question is, will you be there? Are you going to make it of the utmost importance? The world's going to laugh at you because there's nothing in nature that says this day is any different from any other. But it's my word revealed to you that tells you that it is different. And if you enter into it, you will begin to see me more clearly. That spiritual vision will begin to sharpen. And if you don't, it won't. I'm going to make you into my image and likeness, whether you like it or not. You can go easy, you can go hard. You can go in a way where there's no reward, or you can go in a way that there is reward. You can begin to enter that blessing that that day contains even now. Why not begin to portray me and display my traits, your Heavenly Father's traits in your life now? Don't rebel. This is a family rule. You're part of the family. Keep my family rules. David, I saw your hand up over here. Just tell me the part you agree with. No. How's that? Yeah, but that's, yeah, I've heard that. Yeah, David's saying that the body is on a, like a 7-day cycle. It's not a thing that's obvious until you try doing it differently, and people have. It's not something, it's just revealed in nature. It's something you kind of discover when you try to go with an 8-day or 9-day or a 3-day week. You're right, there is. It's just not quite that obvious. But you do begin to find that, again, creation, the creation of your body, syncs with the seventh day. So, yeah, there is truth to that. So I do agree and disagree with what I just said earlier. I'm with you. I agree with you that I disagree with me. So, Adam, your hand was up. I don't know. Seeing as how the Sabbath goes all the way back to the week of creation, it would have been something that Adam was aware of, and his children, and Noah, and his children, and all the way. It was established from the very beginning. It wasn't something new that came in through Moses. It's something that long predates Moses. Moses just reiterates its importance among God's children. So, but yeah, you have a great question. I just don't have a better answer than that, though. I saw a hand up over here. Yes. All right, chapter 2, verse 3. Was that it? No, it's not 3. Which verse? Oh, okay, it is verse 3. Yes, there it is. Yeah, the word is nacham, is the root. This is what it says in the Hebrew. Vayvarech Elohim et yom hashvi'i. And God blessed, varech, baraka, he blessed the seventh day. V'kadeshoto, and he made it kadosh, he made it holy. Kivo shavat, ki in it shavat, he rested, he stopped, I should put it that way, he ceased. Shabbat is an interesting word. It means to purposely cease, whether you're tired or not. You bring it to a close. What's interesting about the word Shabbat, too, is that the way it is spelled, Shin Bet Tov. The last two letters of the Hebrew alphabet, the last two letters of Hebrew alphabet are Shin and Tov. Okay? The last two letters. You take those two letters, the last two letters of the alphabet, and then take the first letter of the Torah, the letter that means house, the letter Beit, you stick it in the middle of those two, and now you have the word Shabbat. Why is that? Well, there are a whole lot of lessons you can gather from that. It's like Beit, which comes at the beginning. God says it's included in the end. That almost as if God took something out of eternity. It's almost like Beit belongs there, but he took it out and says, I'm going to put it back here, but I want you to understand you belong to something at the end, something in the world to come. And this is where your house is to be. Because a person who enters into the Shabbat steps out of this world and steps out of time and steps into the world to come. He gets a fragrance of the world to come. He's saying, this world's passing away. My security does not rest upon this world. My finances do not rest upon this world. My finances and security don't rest upon my work. God has given me work. He's given me responsibilities, but he's also given me the responsibility to step away from them and recognize that is not where my security comes from. My security comes from him. And so I am going to rest here in a finished work. I am going to step out of this present world and spend 24 hours in the world to come at the end of time. It's an amazing picture. Yes, Fred. Shekinah, yes. Yes. Very, very well put. Yes, when the Shekinah enters into the house, it brings this peace with it. It absolutely does. Absolutely does. Well, let's finish our verse that Deborah was asking about. Kivo Shavat, on it he ceases his work. Mikol Milakto, from all of his work. Asher Bara Elohim La'asot, which God created to do. So it's not a word so much there of resting as of ceasing. Now there is another place where it says that he was refreshed, and that's the word nachum. That's where we get the word neham. But it's not like God gets tired and needs refreshed. Nachum is a word that has to do with, kind of associated with breath. He didn't need to catch his breath either. So why does God need to rest? What does that have to do with it? It can't do with fatigue. It can't do with being tired, being out of breath. It simply, I think, means that rest is the normal state in which God exists. He returned to normal. Which means our lives are completely backwards. To us, normal is working all the time, for as much money as we can make. And taking a day off and just spending it with God, that's not normal. But God says, oh yeah, it is. These 6 days a week, Not normal. In fact, part of the curse upon this earth is that it requires more work to bring forth your necessities. Not normal. Rest is what's normal. And laboring into that rest is the work God has given us to do. There's only one time in the Bible I can find God tells us to be afraid, to be very afraid. Now that is that we should fear some promise left us of entering into his rest. We should fall short of it. We're to labor to enter into his rest. Which brings up now the last question, and we'll close. Identify the curses that God placed upon Adam and Eve. That is a trick question. He did not place any curses on Adam and Eve. He cursed the serpent, and he cursed the ground. The word curse is not used when it comes to Adam and Eve. They were not cursed. Oh yeah, he made Eve's birth pains difficult, but that was not called a curse. Yeah, and Adam would have to work harder to bring forth bread from the earth, but it was not called a curse. The curse was on the earth. The curse was on the serpent, not on Adam and Eve. And don't you ever think that God has cursed mankind from the beginning. Isn't true. All right, let's close in prayer. Father, thank you for this time. Thank you for your word and the many hidden treasures it holds for us. So, Lord, I pray as David did, that, Lord, you would open my eyes that I may behold wonders from your Torah. And, Lord, I pray that week by week, we may behold wonders and truths and depths we did not know existed. And as we behold these things, that we would discover that we're actually beholding you spiritually as you are. And that our spiritual vision is becoming more acute. And we're becoming more like you because we're seeing you more clearly. And your determination to make us after your likeness will take another step towards completion. Lord, make us the people you want us to be. And we'll give you praise for it even now in Yeshua's name. Amen.